May I just plunge in and put a yes. the topic and we'll explore it a little bit?
All right.
And
the conversation that we are hearing was recorded way back in 1964, when Robert Penn Warren traveled across the South and interviewed a wide variety of individuals involved in the civil rights movement. This particular conversation was Warren's interview with Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Most of the reel-to-reel audio tapes still exist, and for the first time are now accessible through the Robert Penn Warren Center for the Humanities page on the Vanderbilt University website. Mona Frederick, Executive Director of the Warren Center, joins us to tell how she discovered this audio treasure. Mona, tell us some of the historical background of these audio interviews that Robert Penn Warren conducted. My understanding is they were transcribed for a book, and it was published in 1965, correct?
That's correct. In that year, Warren published a book with Random House with a title that today seems quite provocative to us. The book was entitled Who Speaks for the Negro? And in preparation for trying to answer that question, which Warren ultimately decided could not be answered, he traveled around the United States with an old reel-to-reel audio tape recorder and talked to people involved in the civil rights movement. He talked to people who are quite well known in the movement to us today, like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and James Lawson. But he also interviewed people who were not household names, people who were working more in the trenches of the civil rights movement. So it's quite a historic collection of audio tapes involving people from all parts of the civil rights movement in the mid-60s.
Do you think that Robert Penn Warren realized how prominent some of these people would end up becoming and really how significant this book and the tapes have become?
Well, certainly in 1964, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were huge figures in the civil rights movement. What's surprising in many ways as we look back at that date is that people who of that ilk who were so busy and whose time was so sought after actually took the time to sit down and have a 2 to 3 hour conversation with an English professor from Yale. That's really very surprising. So yes, Warren knew that he was getting access to some of the leading lights of the movement. Other names, perhaps Stokely Carmichael, Andrew Young, Ruth Turner Perot. No, at the time they would have been very young, essentially college students who were active in the movement, as many college students were. The conversations that he had, however, I don't think he would have thought about the importance they would hold for us 40 years later necessarily. Perhaps he would have been surprised to learn that 40 years later, race continues to be a divisive topic in our nation and one that has yet to be resolved completely or cleanly for us all.
Now, what is Vanderbilt's connection to these tapes? Because they were not done here. I guess Robert Penn Warren's, some of his papers are here, but not everything. So how did this all come about that we are able to access this?
About 2 years ago, something came across my desk related to Warren's now out of publication volume, Who Speaks for the Negro, that prompted me to realize that it seemed that these audio tapes might still be in existence. So we began to research that question and indeed discovered that at the Sound Library at Yale University, in what I essentially say is a shoebox, were the original audio tapes from Warren's work. They had never been cataloged, and it doesn't appear that anyone has listened to them since 1964. In the process of that discovery, we also realized that the University of Kentucky is a part of an oral history project that they were working on, had some of the audio tapes, some of the old reel-to-reel audio tapes from Warren's interviews. The librarians at Yale did not realize that they didn't have the full collection and did not realize that Kentucky had some of the tapes and vice versa. The University of Kentucky was unaware that Yale had these tapes. So through the work of the Robert Penn Warren Center for the Humanities staff, we were able to pull the tapes into one place. Now, not the original audio tapes, but Yale copied for us onto CDs the copies of the tapes they had. Our library listened to the tapes, cataloged them and digitized them so that they're available on the internet. The University of Kentucky happily worked with us and digitized the materials that they had and linked those materials are linked through the Jean and Alexander Hurd Library website so that anyone in the world with access to the internet can now go back in time to 1964 and listen to Warren's conversations with an impressive list of people involved in the civil rights movement. Some, at least one, this is an ongoing work in progress, and there's still research involved regarding some of the tapes, as well as the written material pertaining to the project, which will eventually be digitized as well. Warren interviewed a woman named Septima Clark, who is considered to be the grandmother of the civil rights movement. He didn't use any of that material in his book, and no one knew that this audio tape existed of Septima Clark, and that's a really big find.
I was wondering why nobody had ever listened to the tape since then. Was most of the material in the book?
The book is largely made up of what you might call transcripts of the conversations, but there's a lot of Warren in the book. I mean, it's simply not just Warren, he said, she said kind of material. I just think the book is out of print. It happened a long time ago. The Yale Library is a rich resource of material, so the library itself wouldn't necessarily have been interested in that aspect of their collection. And nobody stumbled on it, so I think it was sitting untouched because no one knew it was there.
And Vanderbilt's role then was digitizing the tapes that Yale had.
Yes.
And so did we share this all so that all three libraries are now working together?
Yes. It's a really amazing example of cooperative work in the digital age, how collections at two different libraries can essentially be merged without physically ever moving. What the Vanderbilt Library provided was the staff time and the research work to use the material from the Yale collection, the material from the Kentucky collection, digitize it in a central location, the Vanderbilt Library, and catalog the materials. And so it is really a wonderful example of cooperative work in the digital age. This would not have been possible 20 years ago.
Since Robert Penn Warren was a Vanderbilt alumnus, did his family have any involvement in making this archive possible?
Indeed. His children, Rosanna Warren, who teaches at Boston University, and Gabriel Warren, who teaches at the Rhode Island School of Design, gave us permission to use this material and to post it on the internet so that it could be accessible. And we are indeed very, very grateful to Rosanna and Gabriel for their assistance in helping us make this material available.
Was Robert Penn Warren considered a very visionary person for his time with regards to the civil rights movement?
Actually, Robert Penn Warren, when a student at Vanderbilt University was involved with a literary group known as the Agrarians and later the Fugitives. In retrospect, this group is seen as a relatively racist group of men. There was one woman involved who were proponents of holding on to the old ways of the South. And the old ways of the South were not particularly beneficial to the African-American community. Warren, when he was 24 years old, wrote an essay called The Briar Patch. That essay was included in a volume called I'll Take My Stand, which was a collection of essays written by the members of this movement. His essay argued in favor of separate but equal education for African-Americans. And at the time, that would have been seen as a progressive statement. That is, many of his cohort would not have believed that African Americans were worthy of educating at all. As we look back at that essay from 2008, it does appear racist that he would be arguing for this separate education for African Americans. And as time passed, Warren himself, in his lifetime, in his development as an intellectual, realized the error of that kind of thinking. And he was very early involved in the NAACP. I don't know when he joined, but we did find his NAACP membership card in his papers at Yale. And he introduces the volume Who Speaks for the Negro by mentioning that essay and how it has lived with him for all that time, and that he is pleased to see the civil rights movement underway, and he very much supported that.
So he was someone whose views progressed over time and changed it.
Yes, I sometimes like to think of Warren going from Briar Patch to Who Speaks as the evolution of an intellectual.
And what has Vanderbilt done with regards to having this archive here, and are there any future projects planned?
We hosted a conference April 3rd through 5th of this past year, which coincided with the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. At this conference, we brought together many of the people who were still living that Warren interviewed, as well as activists in current movements today, so that we could have an intergenerational conversation about justice in our society. And that was a very interesting and thought-provoking couple of days. It included luminaries such as Angela Davis, Vanderbilt's own Houston Baker, and many, many others. The list is much too long to go through. And a central part of that was Reverend James Lawson. Reverend Lawson is now a distinguished professor at Vanderbilt University. In the 1960s, as many of you know, he was expelled from Vanderbilt University. So that's the evolution of an institution. Anyway, Lawson was very centrally involved in the planning of the conference and bringing back together people such as himself who were interviewed by Warren. We don't know what the long-term outcome of that gathering may be. We project the possibility of a volume reexamining Warren's provocative question.
Now, you said anybody can access the website, correct?
Anybody with access to the Internet will be able to listen to Warren's interviews.
What particularly stands out to you when you listen to them? Are there any aspects of it that you had not thought about before or perhaps, you know, show what that time?
Well, there's something about the age of these reel-to-reel tapes that makes the listening to the conversation feel like you're there. As I listened to the tapes, I literally felt like I had gotten into a time machine and gone back in time. And I don't know why that particular technology gives one that sense. There is no visual, it's just voices, but you feel like you're in the room with them. There's a conversation between King and Warren, and they're in King's office in Atlanta, and King's phone rings, and King says, "Oh, I'll need to get that." And Warren says, "Fine, I'll hit the pause button," and then there's a pause. You just feel like you are in the room with them. The other interesting part of the tapes to me, which I've touched upon earlier, is the fact that these very, very, very busy people at a very tumultuous time in history were willing to sit down with a white Southern man, an English professor from Yale, and talk for hours about the movement. That's extraordinary to me. I don't yet know why that happened.
Perhaps it suggests at that time people were more accessible in some ways. I mean, not everyone was flooded their day with cell phone and Internet and
email
and you know, people looking at them all the time if they were prominent in politics or whatever they were doing.
I think there's that. I also think that there was a time, and this is just really, but there was a time when there were such things as public intellectuals, and people knew Warren. They knew who he was. They knew his book, All the King's Men. They knew the film, which had been an award-winning film. And I think there were, the role for public intellectuals was more clear or something.
Stronger.
And I think maybe Warren filled that role in a way. But it's still a very interesting fact that and his race can't be discounted from that either. I mean, the fact that he was white and people sat and talked with him. One of the interviewees, Ruth Turner Perot, told me that she actually felt a little angry about doing the interview with him, that though she consented to do it, she felt a bit miffed that who was this white man to come and ask her who speaks for the Negro. She said, I was a little miffed by that. But then she went on to say, but I was young and filled with anger and really didn't want to talk with someone of a different hue. And I thought that was a very elegant way to look back at her youth.
Mona, how is the best way for people to access the archive?
I think the simplest way is to go to the Vanderbilt University website and then locate from there the Warren Center homepage. And there's a direct link on the Warren Center homepage to the digital archive of the library.
Mona Frederick serves as executive director of the Robert Penn Warren Center for the Humanities. For Interview, I'm Emory Dear Owens.